The fairy tale promise of the happy ending is really only an olive branch held out to the reader that there might be a way of exiting this unbearable reality.
Hello and welcome to this short fiction masterclass brought to you by Thresholds, the International Short Story Forum, in collaboration with the Charleston Trust. My name is Jack Catania and I'm at the Small Wonder Festival talking to the acclaimed author, critic and cultural historian, Marina Warner, CBE. Marina's critical and historical work explores different figures in myth and fairy tale, while her fiction translates or revisions these sources. She says that stories come from the past, but speak to the present. Today we're going to be talking about Marina Warner's collection of short stories, Fly Away Home, which has just been published, but the stories themselves have been broadcast or published over the last decade or so. So we're going to start off with Marina reading After the Fox in the beginning.
The hole appeared under the twisting stems of the wisteria on the south wall of Judith's garden. It gaped too large and too deep for a vole or a rat. Judith knew the size of their runnels from the banks of the canal two streets away, and when she'd had the outside lavatory at the back demolished, small, neat tunnel heads soon dotted the mud where the builder had trodden the old lawn. When she managed to call him back again, he kicked at the holes and asked her for empties. Taking three wine bottles from her recycling, he dropped them into a bin liner, hammered them thoroughly till the plastic slumped like a sandbag, and then dug down into the old waste stack and stuffed it. "They'll not make their way up through Cullet," he said. She remembered the word, so satisfying in its finality. But this hole was wider than a rat hole, bigger even than a cat flap. This visitor was no small burrower. When Judith went out to look at her garden one morning, hoping to find the first cyclamen uncurling their delicate heads, she caught a panicky flash of fur and the scramble of nails on the garden wall. An animal was writhing for a foothold on the brickwork. When Judith stood still, the creature's first panic subsided, and she could sense, though she could not actually see, how the soft white fur in the hollows of the animal's pricked ears quivered to pick up the human's response. Then, hearing no reverberating anger, the creature found its centre of gravity and levered itself on narrowy, orangey haunches to vault with a squirm and a shove up and over into the next-door neighbour's garden. A vixen, thought Judith, and a young one, too, far smaller than a spayed hearth cat, and scrawny. The hole must be a branch exit in a lattice of communications running under the gardens adjoining one another near her. In this part of the city where she'd lived all her adult life with Ian, until one morning in tears, he said he'd always love her, but that now he had to care for Amanda. Judith was so resilient and proactive. She was a woman who could manage on her own. Amanda needed him more. Since then, Judith found that to her own way of thinking, she was now widowed. Death fixes memories, defaces the present, and fills every moment with the past ablaze. His absence kept her mind in perpetual rewind. This is became this was. The time now, the time then. This place here, that place there, when he, when we, did this and said that, ate this and saw that. The sequence end-stopped, the frame frozen, flickered slightly in the light of her recall. The picture screened out everything else, beyond the possibility of change, except for paling in patches, like colour prints leaching slowly of light. This past mocked her as it flung at her. "You just didn't see it, did you? You missed the signs. You didn't know that moment was the beginning of the end, and that one the continuation of that beginning and that end."
Thank you very much. That's a really sensitive, I think, an interesting view of how probably we as humans experience the past. The past talks to the present. You've spoken how stories from the past talk to the present. And in this instance, Judith begins the story by revisiting, revising her past, looking at her past. But as the story moves on, as the narrative develops, she begins to inhabit the past of her lover
in quite a strange and unusual way. So I wondered if you could tell us a bit about that.
Well, the story is, as quite a lot of my stories are, it's kind of watermarked with a fairy tale, because this is a revision of Bluebeard.
Bluebeard, indeed.
And Judith is actually the name of the heroine of Bluebeard in some of the versions. And when she opens the garden shed in the story, and she finds the traces of a previous lover or wife in the... that, of course, is the Bloody Chamber, but the Divine is a sort of merciful one. It's about that we all have rather complicated paths when we get to a certain age.
Yes.
And many of us have loved in different ways at different times with tremendous intensity, but it doesn't... We are actually, fortunately, as a species, quite capable of many different experiences. I mean, one love doesn't necessarily exclude the possibility of another. They will be very different. I don't think... I think it's a very bad idea to try and repeat, you know, youthful love or the love one has for a child. You know, every person demands a different relationship. But it took me quite a lot of living to come to the terms with that.
Yes.
And I suppose the story is about jealousy.
Yes.
And she is visited by all the ghosts of the previous wives.
Mm-hmm.
And they live in the house with her.
Yes.
And I try to do it quite realistically, so you're not actually quite sure if they're ghosts or not.
Yes.
They do seem to be there. Which is what
tangible ghosts.
Yes, what I believe, which was what I believe about the kind of way of writing fairy tale. It's not to make it fantastic, it's to try and domesticate it into the ordinary texture of reality. And I suppose the story is about the fact that she sees this fox for the first time. This was written when urban foxes were actually quite so common.
Mm.
And I was very shocked when I first found one in my garden. It's about how even when you think you actually have reached a terminus,
yes,
that actually it can be the beginning of another phase.
So,
and the Bluebeard character, I have actually thought for quite a long time that the story of Bluebeard is not so much about a serial murderer, which of course is the most famous version, but of somebody who's been married before, and the wife has died, that the new wife is haunted by the... More like a Rebecca.
Like Rebecca.
Yes. And so this is an attempt to sort of come to this story is a... It's probably the happiest story in the book, actually, isn't it? Because it has a happy ending.
Because the character does come to terms with it, and she begins to inhabit. And I think what she said about the texture of everyday life, entering into it, the myth, works very well, because she begins to wear the clothes of the past lovers, and in that way begins to get some of their joy and some of their qualities and some of what happens in their relationships. So the Bluebeard myth works really well.
One does bring one's own, you know, feelings, experiences and thoughts into stories, even if one is not writing, as it were, a memory or an autobiography. But it is true that I think that is one of the best methods of overcoming jealousy.
Yes.
In fact, is to simply, enjoy the possibility of sort of projections, a strange kind of projection.
Yes.
Rather than looking in agony at the photograph of the beautiful woman who was your predecessor.
Mm.
But writing itself is. That's the other thing, is that myth and self-protection.
Yes.
And I think this is expressed through mythic rewritings and retellings, taking terrible stories, such as Medea or Bluebeard.
Yes.
And then sort of raising them as a kind of shield against that happening again, either by thinking them through into another place. So, for example, Christa Wolf wrote quite a famous novel in which Medea does not kill her children. So, in a sense, Christa Wolf, in that book, is rewriting Medea to be stronger than her myth.
And reclaiming the energy of Medea.
Yes. And Christa Wolf, being herself rather persecuted at the time, was using that to kind of vindicate herself as well.
I think what's interesting in this story is that immediately that Judith opened the shed, I thought it'd be Bluebeard, because these things are imprinted on us, aren't they, these ancient myths. And so there was fear there on my part as a reader, wondering what would happen, wondering what she would discover. You know, was there something really terrible that
happened? Nasty in the woodshed.
Exactly, nasty in the woodshed. And so that the myth actually haunted, the actual myth actually haunted the story and gave it a depth.
Mm.
And I was wondering, when you come to write, rewrite or revision myths, does, which comes first? The character? Did Judith come first to you as a person? Or did the myth demand to be rewritten? Which, can you remember which came first?
I find it, each story is very different. The kind of sparks that, you know, like flints that I can strike together.
Yes.
So, I mean, this one was definitely that I mean, the silt in that story is quite deep, because I've been writing a lot about Bluebeard for a long time. Mm. But I think it really was sparked by the vixen in my garden. And the two are not really connected. It was just the idea of something completely new in London.
Yes.
A sort of new break.
Yes.
Yeah, but other stories, I mean, there was a ballad called The Cruel Mother, in which is in many, many different versions, but there are lots and lots of Scottish versions. But one of the versions I came across, which I haven't actually been able to find again since, oddly enough, but anyway, she goes by to go dancing in the local village hall, and the child who she abandoned and who dies cries out from the grave, "Mother, you're going dancing on," you know. And so I put that one together with the idea of a woman who's trying to have a baby.
Yes,
and Lady Bird,
yes, Lady Bird.
In the story called Lady Bird, that's right. So they came together. So the idea was that it's very possibly quite difficult to work out from the story what exactly happened. But in my mind, what happened is the baby dies.
Yes,
because his mother went dancing and didn't have a babysitter.
Yes,
and then this my character, my protagonist, who's trying to have a baby, the baby appears in the dress that was being worn by the dancing mother.
Yes.
I mean, it's a sort of strange, it's a ghost story.
It's a ghost story, but it's also, it's a miraculous story. It speaks to the miracle, I think. And it's a very short story. It's quite a slight story.
Yes,
but the imagery in it is powerful. And I had a very strong image of flames to do with the loss of the baby and the dress.
Mm. It did happen near us, actually, in London. There was a dreadful fire. And the sofa caught fire, and this family died, but the mother didn't die because it was just that sort of accident.
Yes.
And I mean, absolutely unbearable.
Yes.
And I found walking past that house so hard, you know, for so long. It was such a haunted house.
Mm. And the story has the power to reclaim and transform even our own personal traumas, I think.
Yes,
the trauma of myth. Mm. That brings me on to something I wanted to mention to you, which is the idea of the past, and the past is a very strong presence throughout. Many of your characters have different experiences of what it is to go back into the past, or they worry about that the past will disillusion them. And there's the section in the story Sing For Me where the captain procurator says, "Who's telling the story? Whose voice am I hearing?" And I think this is what we've been talking about, really. But it made me think of one of the stories in the book called Brigitte Cell, which enacts who's telling the past, who's talking about the past. And you interdisperse the voice of a contemporary teacher taking her students on a school trip, Annie, and her voice speaking to her students, her pupils, and with the voice of an anchorite, a 13th century anchorite. And I think Annie relates to the voice, but they never meet, they never interact. So you've got these two interior voices or exterior voices or monologues happening in the story. And I thought that was really interesting as a device.
Well, thank you. I sort of, one of the things that I find miraculous about literature, it is so fresh.
Yes.
When it's ancient. I mean, to me, it's a tremendous fund of hope that we have sympathy with Bronze Age, you know, women who's,
yes,
in the Iliad, you know, Hecuba or Andromache.
Yes.
We completely understand what they're feeling about their children, about their fathers, about their brothers, their city. The past really does speak.
Yes.
And one of the reasons that I feel that we, you know, need the humanities, which are sort of under stress, under tremendous,
yes,
criticism for being kind of luxuries and useless and not training people for things, is that we actually would have none of this knowledge without them. What we know of past peoples is in the things they left behind, and of course it's infinitely mysterious. They've just found a whole new enormous Stonehenge. We don't know what Stonehenge was built for, and we don't know what this new one was built for, which is later. But so it's not the same, exactly the same society. So these things are, you know, very powerful evidence, but they're also kind of secret, and that calls to us. So I think a lot of, you know, what I try to do is, in a sense, listen to the past.
Yes.
It's exactly like Annie in the... I mean, that what there is, that was inspired by seeing an anchorite cell in Utrecht. And my hotel was right opposite the church in which there was the war where she had been... And she was a saint. It was a slightly different story. But so, you know, that was just me was trying to, as it were, try to hear her experience.
Yes. And her experience is so vivid and poetic, but poetic in the sense of resonating with the present.
Well, that one is... I mean, that was written for the radio, so it was written to a certain length. And actually, in a way... You know, once you've written a story, this is one of the difficulties, that you it has its own sort of musical dynamic, and it's pretty hard to amplify, I find, afterwards. But I think that's a story that could do with some amplification, but I did do quite a lot of revising and rewriting. Bridget's cell is a version of the Blood, I don't know how to say her name, the flower maiden from the Mabinogion.
Yes.
It's that version. It's quite, and you know, Alan Garner did a wonderful book called *The Owl Service*, which was the same myth.
Mm-hmm.
I rather like that. I like to share. I like the feeling of being connected to writers in the same pool in the ocean of stories. You know that we've both done that particular story in different ways.
And of course, it links in with the kind of culture of Holland, the flowers, the trade, the links with England. All those things they formed there. Annie's mother went to Liverpool, so they're kind of threads spun across the sea, geographic as well as deep in time.
Thank you.
And what you've said about being linked to other writers is really salient, because I wanted to ask about, there is a story written here, particularly for this collection, Watermark, which talks about M.R. James in relationship to the murals in Lady of Eaton Chapel, which you explore with some speculation and some quite in-depth investigation into what it meant to have icons and stories which are iconic and particular to the Catholic Church being whitewashed, literally being whitewashed, vanishing. And also perhaps their histories being unknown. So I got from the story that the stories of the people who painted these icons were kind of lost in time, but you were imagining them. And so there's a great deal of research that's gone into this narrative. And I was wondering how you as a writer would advise other writers to gain the balance between narrative, between imagination and the research that you do.
The interesting thing is that fiction that doesn't even look as if it's been researched often is.
Yes.
Because the process of writing demands accuracy.
Yes.
At a rather basic level. I mean, it's quite hard to get somebody, you know, into a house and onto a train and, you know, without actually looking at a map. Because even if you're not writing realist fiction, you really have to work through the possibilities, because otherwise it just becomes, you can write dream fantasy.
Yes.
That's one thing.
That's
where you break all the rules.
Mm.
But most fiction that uses magical elements or supernatural elements or doesn't actually wish to do naturalism, straightforward verismo, veristic naturalism, you still need to reason it through to make it work, because the reader otherwise will not have a purchase on making the mind pictures, the thought pictures, that he or she needs to make. You actually have to give that all. I mean, I always try to kind of think how I sometimes, you know, get up in my room and actually do the movements to make sure that I'm getting it right. You know, like the fox scrambling up the wall, and I sort of try to get myself really into it to feel, you know, what would be the twist, the pounce, the whatever of it. So I think that's an important aspect. I think it's a fault in me that I do too much research. One novel that I wrote, you know, absolutely everything in it is really, really accurate, down to the sort of month and date. That's The Lost Father. But I was very interested in, my mother said, you know, that Italy had changed totally, and her childhood had vanished. I mean, Italy was now in a different place.
Yes.
So I interviewed her, and then I looked at many, many books of history, many books of photographs about Italy in the 20s and 30s, to get it right,
yes.
get the music right, you know, sympathy. But I think it's a sort of fault. I think one shouldn't rely too much on research. Otherwise, there's a bit of the lamp, smell of the lamp about the fiction. So I've tried to resist my antiquarian impulses. But with M.R. James, the fact that he is an antiquarian, and he is the kind of protagonist of that story, and he uncovered these frescoes. He remembered that the story begins when he, as a schoolboy, he sees them move a piece of furniture in the chapel.
Yes.
And under that piece of furniture, he sees a painting. And when he became the provost, the actual overall authority at the School of Eton, he had the paintings uncovered.
Mm-hmm.
So he restored them.
Yes.
All these Catholic paintings of extraordinary miracles of the Virgin Mary, in which she takes the part of sinners and she delivers a woman who's having a baby. She takes the baby to save them. You know, I mean, it's an extraordinary, exactly what the Protestants hated.
Yes.
Very, very indulgent, slightly sensuous miracles.
Mm.
And lots of
female miracles.
And female miracles too, exactly, yes. So he uncovers that, and then he's the great master of the Victorian short story, and goes into the Edwardian period too, but he's one of the great figures in that very English tradition.
Yes.
And it just struck me that, and in his short stories, the objects are haunted.
Yes.
And they're often religious objects, or sort of slightly religious objects, sort of choir stalls, or a strange missal or prayer book.
Yes.
And it struck me that this was because he felt so strongly the destruction of the Catholic powers, the sort of spells that the Catholics had cast through their miracle work. But he remained an Anglican, so for him it was a transgression to feel the spell. And this seemed to me to be the origin of his characters, who are horribly haunted and by demons.
Mm-hmm.
So I did do a bit of, I researched him, because he was a researcher himself. So.
Yes. Well, I know the advice is always, if writers are aiming for a magical realism, to get the realism right, which is what you've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Get the detail, get the history, get the richness. Mm. But I find in your writing it's very sensory, it's very sensual, it's not abstract. And I think a very good example of that is The Chatelaine in the Making, which is another short story of yours, which begins all in 19th century France. And I was wondering if you would read us the beginning of that.
After Clara's father, the young corporal Gaspard Dufay, fell in the mud at Verdun with a bullet through the heart, Clara began to dance. Her mother, Eglantine Dufay, made her costumes, sometimes dressing her as a doll, or a cherry in summer, a holly berry at Christmas, or a pixie, and would sit watching her closely while Clara performed in cafes and bars. 3 years later, the little dancer was noticed by a customer, a tall gentleman in a top hat and gloves, and procured a place in the corps de ballet at the Paris Opera. Clara became one of that select and celebrated company known as Les Petits Rats, whom Degas has immortalized in the famous bronze statue with her upturned face and a real tutu. In the photograph which the unfortunate Gaspard had in his pocket, close to the entry point of the German bullet that killed him, the little dancer was curly-haired and chubby, consistently inspiring her first audiences to coo, "Comme elle est adorable," as they fixed her monocles to see her better. By the age of 9, however, Clara had changed. She'd grown rangy, with a surprisingly long, thin neck, wrists and back, like the Saluki dogs coming into fashion in that pleasure-loving decade after the First World War. In the chorus, dancing en pointe and wearing the flounced muslins of a villi or a sylph, she moved with an easy languor that belied the difficulty of the steps and the arduousness of the regime. For in spite of the hours, the rigours, and the fatigue of the dancing, the opera became a place of safety for Clara, with allies in the company and friendly faces in the pit, where the musicians played so beautifully. The violin's sweet singing lines and the music's intricate rhythms gave her passage to an enchanted island, where she could reach the grace inside her, beyond the turbulent world of the smoke-filled cafes where she had skipped and strutted as a tot. Yet she was growing tall, taller than most of her partners in the chorus line. The gentleman in the top hat and gloves had continued to take an interest in the little family. He was an inventor, a collector, and a designer who specialised in curiosities, which he sold to other collectors. He had a reputation as a great connoisseur. He supported Clara's mother, who was now making fans, and painting them with scenes inspired by their benefactor's taste for chinoiserie and other oriental motifs. Monsieur de Rivegarde, for this was the tall gentleman's name, backed the boutique on the Rue Saint-Honoré, where she could sell her creations, chez Eglantine, Fabricant Éventail, Aigrette, Fantaisie. That's 80A Hoffman, that's the Nutcracker.
Yes.
It was written for Christmas, actually, for Harper's Bazaar. It's based on the Nutcracker. The Nutcracker's a very, very peculiar story. I mean, it's turned into this wonderful Christmas fantasia, but it's very bizarre, with this funny inventor. I mean, mine is closer to Hoffman than the ballet.
Yes, and I did notice that it was originally published as The Isle of Lanterns, or Young Man in a Gondola and Air Balloon after Hoffman's Nutcracker Suite. Yes, I noticed that.
That was because it was the Christmas original issue, yes.
Yes. And so Clara is the heroine of this story.
Yes, yes.
And she escapes.
Well, actually...
Does she escape?
I mean, it's left open, as some of the other stories too. I think Kate Clancy yesterday said that she didn't really like writing stories with a clinching twist,
yes,
at the end. And though I'd never made a conscious decision about that, some of my earlier short stories did end. They did exit on actual, real, sort of classic short story,
yes,
twist. But I have stopped doing that. And this is definitely an open-ended one. And I think there is a quotation from one of the fairy tale scholars of the last century, André Jolez, and he says that in such stories, the miraculous is the only guarantee that the unbearability of reality has stopped.
Yes.
And that was a quote I came across recently, I mean, after writing that story, but that's what it's about. It's about the fairy tale promise of the happy ending.
Yes.
It's really only an olive branch held out to the reader that there might be a way of exiting this unbearable reality.
Yes.
And that's the sweetness of the story that works on you. But it doesn't really convince you.
It doesn't convince you.
I don't think so. I don't think that we are really convinced when Cinderella... I mean, Hollywood probably and many other vehicles have thrown a lot of money at trying to convince us that that is going to be the happy ending, that when she marries the prince.
Yes.
But actually, it's not quite that. What is the consolation for the child or the adult reading Cinderella is that she has at least left that unbearable situation before, or that unbearable situation has been changed in some way. So I'm afraid that, I mean, if you press me, I don't really think that the wallpaper came to life and the young man stepped out of the out of the wallpaper and picked her up and put him in the basket of the air balloon and took her away from her fate to be the child mistress of this
old man. Yeah.
And I'm afraid it's to do with female lack of resources.
Yes.
And one of the sort of structural endemic problems which fairy tales reflect very, very well, the dependency that some women in the past, most women in the past, have on the male protector, be it a father figure or the feudal lord or husband. So that's something that's very much preoccupied me all my life. And so this is a story in which that is dramatised in a way that I hope sort of gives you a sense of the confinement. I mean, Clara is caught. There's not much else she can do.
Yes.
Except she can escape.
In her imagination.
In her imagination, yes. I'm afraid I don't think she does. I'm afraid he is coming up the stairs.
I did pick up that theme running through the story, and I think you've put it very succinctly as the female lack of resources. Also, stories in a story that intrigued me because I felt that it could actually have become a longer story, and that's See No Evil, where the protagonist, in fact, the point of view character, Dr. Diogenes Earle, has not just one mistress, but his view of his world and his view of his experiments on monkeys, because he's a medical researcher, and his view of the women he sleeps with is completely coloured by his position and his lack of imagination, in fact, and we as the reader see that the points of view of the women in the story are not the same as his. And I felt that that was such an interesting and full world that that story could have indeed become a longer narrative. And I was wondering for you as a writer, what determines whether a story does become a short story or does become a novel?
Well, I need to be very accustomed to the world I'm inhabiting for the book or for the piece of writing. And that story is set in the Caribbean. And I don't really know the Caribbean well enough to... I would have had to move it to Europe or to America to get it right. And actually, I did want to keep it there because that scene at the end of the story did happen with the coconuts.
Yes.
And actually, I also... I mean, I was interested in that aspect of... I mean, it is actually the case that there is an AIDS laboratory, one of the great AIDS laboratories in St. Kitts, I think it is, because they have the indigenous monkeys there that are close to us in their DNA, etc. So, and one of the other things I think short stories and fiction both are very, very good for is exploring and turning around and revolving very difficult questions. And you don't necessarily, I mean, it's up to the reader to decide whether they think he should be experimenting with monkeys or not. I mean, that's up to the reader to decide. But this is what's happening. He is a biomedical researcher on a very necessary vaccine, which has actually saved a lot of people's lives for AIDS. And it's set in the developing world. It's not set in the metropolitan West, because that's where the monkeys are indigenous.
And I think that story succeeded because of the final image of the story, which brought it all together, where the researcher actually lies down next to a monkey who's recovering from an operation. And there's a comfort there, the comfort that crosses species almost. And somehow, though many of the questions in the story aren't resolved, the power of the image is that it brings together two realities.
I mean, I do think there's a way in which I write stories about things that puzzle me. And I don't expect to find the answer, but I expect to feel closer to the feelings of the question. So in this case, it's also about old age. And he's old, this hero, this protagonist. He's old and he's questionable and he's suspect and he's from another era when it comes to sort of sexual mores. So all those things are very problematic. And I would, if I wrote an essay about it, I would write it in a very different way.
Of course. But fiction somehow elevates and allows it to exist with all its contradictions intact.
Yes, and it just takes one a little bit further into the texture of the problem. I mean, I sometimes, you know, take up different... I sort of surprise myself, and a lot of it's instinctive. I mean, the... And one of the difficulties about writing it is that you need to be in a sort of receptive, almost abstracted frame of mind. And that's hard for me to achieve now because I have a lot of responsibilities and duties and claims on my time. Because that sort of image, that final image where he... That just... I mean, there was no sort of conscious decision about that. That just... They come as images. They come up. The images return in different ways. I mean, if I find time to write, it's one of the things I like about it, is that it's a... It's a sort of form of transport. You go, you know, you take off somewhere, and you're very surprised by yourself. It's actually, it's not unlike speaking. You know, when one speaks, one has no idea. One's not formulating the speech as one speaks. it sort of happens. Well, that's harder to achieve in writing, to get to that stage where it's just happening. And somehow you're almost receiving it rather than producing it.
Thank you so much for talking to us, Marina. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you very much
for your insight and wisdom.
Well, thank you so much for reading them so carefully. Thank you.